Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Star Chamber Show, episode number 112. And we're here with you on a Wednesday evening, and it's actually a pretty balmy evening here in central Kentucky. Don't know how it is elsewhere, but we've got my two co-hosts from elsewhere, Daniel Dark and Michael West, covering Indiana and Tennessee. So how are you guys doing tonight, and what's up?
Hey, all right.
I am still alive, and that's about as good as I can say it this week.
Yeah, Daniel's toughing it out a little bit tonight because he and Michael and myself were at the Kentuckiana Authors Fair 8th Annual Edition in LaGrange, Kentucky this Saturday, and Daniel came down with a little bug afterwards, and so he's toughing it out tonight to co-host. So I just want to give everybody a little heads up. He's a trooper, and he's with us, obviously. And we'll try not to put too much pressure on him tonight. But it was cool seeing you guys. I mean, we had a good time. It was, I mean, the day actually moved fast for me. I mean, it really did. I looked up and it was already like 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
That's because you never stayed around your booth.
Well, it's such a gathering, though, and it's like so cool to see everybody. I mean, like our neighbors were people we love, of course, T. Lee Harris and Marion Allen and Sarah Marion from Per Bastet. And on the other side, we had the Hoffmans, Paul and Kimberly Hoffman, and, of course, Daniel's with me. And then they had Michael in another aisle, and we had the – you know, and down toward his end, on our side, it was, I could just go on forever about all the people that we know that were there. I mean, we had Kathy Jackson, of course, and we had Misty
RJ.
Parker and Neil Sijatovic and RJ and Chrissy Garrison. And it was, and then all the folks down there with Ren Garcia and James Erickson. And it's really a reunion in so many ways, and many of us have been, like Michael and I, go way back on this one, and this was Daniel's first trek, I think, on this one. So, but he's
yes.
Now a veteran of the KAF, and we did our traditional meal, so that's when it's official. When we always do our traditional dinner afterwards, and then we hit Big R and Shannon's, the barbecue place, which is delightful. And it was awesome because Michael picked up the tab for everybody afterwards, and we had a really good time. But
you're going to start the show out by lying, aren't you? Okay, I see.
Yeah. The only thing I picked up the tab for this week is maybe the tail fin on a cruise missile or something, you know, with my tax bill to Uncle Sam.
Oh, man. Yeah. Well, we'll try to cheer you up tonight, and we certainly got a cool guest coming up, but we'll leave that for a few more minutes. We got to catch up.
I'm in a fairly good mood because on Friday 13th, my short story, Ave Santani, went up for pre-sale through Seven Star Press eBooks. And it entered the top 100, and it has stayed there for the last week. So it's been very cool.
Yep.
Great.
And keep those pre-orders coming in. It helps. I can't say it enough. People just they think I'm joking when I tell them sometimes. I think even readers do. But it helps authors immensely when you pre-order. It does. Because what happens is, okay, well, for you, you don't have to worry about it. It's going to be automatically delivered to your device. So it's done. You know, automatic setup, and you have nothing more to worry about. They have release; it comes right to your device. But on the R end, what happens is it counts in the first day sales. And so if there's a bunch of pre-orders that all kind of flow into that at once when the book is released, it actually helps give it a real kickstart, especially if there's a fair number of pre-orders. And the book will actually start out higher on the chart. And if you get a really good chart position in a modest category on Amazon, it will actually make you visible to the other readers browsing ebooks, and if you're toward the top of a category, and that can actually help more people discover you and the sales sustain if that happens. It's very, very helpful when you do pre-order. So Michael's is only 99 cents to do so. So I definitely encourage you to do that. And I'd encourage you to do one other thing.
Go back and review it. Even if you only put one little sentence down there, review it. That helps out immensely.
Yep. Yeah, especially the day and age of Amazon, arbitrarily kind of knocking reviews out of authors' review counts and things like that. And I mean, I'm talking legitimate reviews too. I mean, it's we've talked about that in the show before, but what Daniel's saying is absolutely true. I mean, the reviews absolutely help, and they help with the way algorithms work on these sites and everything, and also just when you see a cluster of review, larger cluster of reviews, it helps. Helps buyers, kind of give you the nod when they're kind of on the fence about whether or not to try you out. So it definitely helps. And I've actually got a new one myself up. It's $1.99. It's because it's novella sized, but Blood of a Queen, new Raiden Valkyrie novel, is also up for pre-order. And so that's the next one in that batch. And it's an exciting time. We've got Dan Jolly up for pre-order of his book 3, Grey Widow's War, in the Grey Widow trilogy. So yeah, at Seven Star Press, we've actually got 3 titles currently up on the pre-order chart. So that's, I think, a first for us to have 3 at the same time up for pre-order. But it's really, really cool. But yeah, Michael's comes out on April the 27th. So Let's get that one a real good boost and get that to the chart topper, So that'll be awesome. And before we go too far, though, I do want to say something that may be a little somber, but I think it's appropriate. Since our last show, one of my favorite broadcasters of all time, and just actually somebody that I really just loved, and it ties into my relationship with my grandmother on my mother's side and everything, and even inspired one of my main characters in the Rising Dawn saga. But Art Bell of Coast to Coast AM passed away, and he's a true maverick. I mean, just an amazing, amazing broadcaster, fascinating, fascinating show, and so many people I know. It's gotten so many people through third shifts, long drives. I mean, got me through lots of stuff during my post-college years, and I was a night owl, of course, and it just really was a bummer to hear that he had passed on, because I just thought he was one of the best hosts that I've ever seen, especially dealing with these kind of topics they did on Coast to Coast, because he was always insightful. His questions were always he had really command of the subject, and he always gave his guests and callers respect. I mean, he always gave them a real good treatment on the air, no matter how outlandish or kind of wild the topic might be. And I just thought that, he always looked to me as an example of what I call a true intellectual, a guy that really is open-minded and open to new evidence, new data, new things. And he was a quintessential intellectual to me. And I love the way he treated, the mysterious. And I don't know about you guys, but I mean, he was a big force in my world for a while. And I definitely want to, like I said, I hope he's off to grand explorations now. So, Were you guys Art Bell fans back in the day?
I'm trying to remember who he actually is.
Yeah, I was familiar with him, but I don't know that I actually ever listened to the show.
No? Now, see, I figured you would because of the horror background with all the cryptozoology he covered and all the Nephilim lore and possession stuff with Malachi Martin. And, oh, man, God, you would – well, since you didn't listen to the show, I will say that you would have loved it. And, I mean, it's still good. I mean, I still check in the Coast to Coast AM sometimes, but it's just not quite the same level that Art brought to it. It was a whole different ball game when he was the host, and like I said, a lot of weirdness surrounding his own career and even a little mystery, over his circumstances of how he passed. So I mean, it's nothing cut and dry when it comes to Art Bell, that's for sure. But I was definitely very sad to see that happen. So, but. Anyway, I wanted to acknowledge that, though, because he is such a maverick broadcaster and definitely a big, influence a lot of speculative fiction kind of categories and folks. So, but with that said, though, we are going to take things toward a positive direction. And I will first quote the great Yngwie Malmsteen, guitar player, who once said,
yeah,
"Less is not more, more is more." And, well, tonight we have more for you all, and in the form of a very, very talented guy who is a very brilliant author, great character, great attitude, and the guy that I have loved being a friend of and working with, and he's just had a blast with him last year's Imaginarium, and I know both of you guys will comment a little bit on this, but wanted to bring him on the show early so we can get the convo with the main man underway. The one and only Carl R. Moore. You are on the air, sir.
Good evening.
Hey, Carl.
There he is.
What's going on, gentlemen? It's been far too long.
Yes, it has.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes,
but what a pleasure and an honor it is to be here, Stephen, with Seven Star Press and all the real outlaws.
Oh, it's, well, we got quite a quartet tonight between me you and Daniel and Michael. And Michael,
right.
Michael kind of reminds me a little bit of Art Bell in one way tonight. He's I'm sure he's in his little horror museum bunker off in Indiana there.
I'm in my lair.
Perfect. Yeah. Well, I'm on my back porch in a fur hat. I hope nobody tried to take me for game here. It's pretty cold still up this way.
and you, sir, I believe got Woodford Reserve for your drink of the evening. So that I commend you on excellent choice.
I think we got some good default sponsorship here. I just poured myself a little sniffer of Woodford and I'm ready to rock.
You got it.
This has been my go-to. Although I'd say, it's hover between Wild Turkey, Knob Creek, and Woodford, but lately it's been shaved down mostly to the Wild Turkey and the Woodford.
Nice. And
I'm trying
to
get Stephen into a Tennessee person. So
that's right.
he's trying. Daniel has introduced me to White Rabbit, which actually turned out very well. It's a very smooth, wonderful Jack Daniels offering, and so I definitely am deeply grateful to Daniel for that introduction. I'll definitely give it respect, even though I'm in bourbon.
I'm looking forward to my first trip to Tennessee sometime, and I'll do the cultural Tennessee whiskey tour with the best guide, I think.
Oh yes. No, got it, man. Yeah, we would love to have you on tour down here in our area. Hanging out with you is fun. I mean, it's just like, okay, from the first moment we saw you at Imaginarium, is like, all right, the party started. Carl is one guy you definitely would hang around with at a convention.
And I'm really proud to say, and also thanks to you, and also especially thanks to Holly, that I made it to that early panel discussion on Saturday, despite our festivities, which is really bodes well for the future.
Yes,
but yeah, it's not really a weekend for sleeping. It's Yeah.
No gathering of creatives is ever that. And that's what we were kind of talking about earlier with the Kentuckiana Authors Fair. It's like we get in a room and, like Daniel said, you know, I'm scampering off to talk to 30 different people and this, that, and the other. And yeah, because it's like you get among your people and it's a vibe and it just kind of takes a life of its own. It's awesome. And we clicked with you from day one, and you were actually Daniel's table neighbor. Or table
right.
mate, I think it imaginary.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I owe it's not just the bourbon, I owe a lot to Daniel's Jolt Cola supply as well.
Yeah.
he showed up with
hey,
a cooler.
Hey, he brought me one this weekend. I got a Jolt on Saturday from Mr. Dark here. So I did get a midday kind of boost, as it were.
Yep.
And it was excellent. And I had the empty can and Michael saw it and was like, ah, oh! So there's great picture on Instagram with Michael and the Jolt Cola can. So unfortunately,
exactly.
It had been downed by that point, but
well, you know, that's how Daniel Dark rolls. You know, you know, it was a weekend of Jolt Cola, bourbon and butcher knives.
Butcher knives, swords. I mean, you never know what Daniel Dark will show up with.
You've got to have something to trim a cigar with. So,
exactly. Exactly.
Oh
yeah.
Man,
it was
great. We had a good time. We got to visit with Daniel and his wife, and had a really good dinner afterwards. I don't know if you caught that part in the early part of the show, but we had our traditional like dinner gathering afterwards.
Oh,
and
cool.
Michael's wife came with him, and so we had a
nice
group with us. It was a good group.
Yeah,
and even Tony
cool.
Tony Acri, and Tony, if you're listening, see, I pronounced your name right. I've been calling him Acri for years, and he just now finally says, well, it's actually Acri. But, you know, even I've known him, like, incredibly
gotcha.
Well for years. But, Acre.
Sure it's not Acrid?
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah, we bailed him out because he was, at the end of the day, it's like everybody's pretty much gone. And he was like, well, I got to stay and put up all these tables. And there's like, oh, God, what, you know, 60, 70 tables with chairs out in the middle of this big gymnasium in the YMCA. And so we had a last-minute scrounge up of a handful of volunteers, and we helped Tony get out of trouble. But that's what you do in our world. You look out for each other, and so we were able to get it done in time so Tony could join us at dinner, and he did a great job with this year, and hopefully one of the years you'll get to make it down for that, because it is an enjoyable
that's cool.
gathering for sure.
Were people doing
and,
like readings?
No, it's strictly a book fair. I mean, strictly a book fair
okay.
at this point. I mean, Tony may have plans for other things in the future, but it's I can't speak for him for what, but to date, it's pretty much traditionally been a book fair.
Gotcha.
And
that sounds
it's
cool.
A good
yeah.
bunch. It's a nice mix. It's an all genre kind of event, so you got it all.
Right.
And if Kenzie Michaels is listening, oh, I got to call her out on this one. This is so funny. We went up to her. She's a romance author, you know, erotica romance and all. And I go
right.
to the table, and she has this little swag plate. And on the swag plate, I'm not kidding you, is she had little book covers of erotic romance titles that were kind of like the covers for packs of Kleenex tissues. I am not kidding you. And
that's a good one.
I just looked at her and I go, I have never seen this before. I was like, it was the erotic romance author giving out like, you know, packs of tissues, you know.
Well, I mean, if ketchup goes with Jack the Ripper, I think Kleenex goes with romance. And I'm not talking about weeping.
Oh, I know.
But,
I know about. Oh, I'm almost ready to cry now, laughing. And I took it to Michael immediately, and he couldn't breathe for a second. He started laughing so hard. I think. My God, that was good. I think we all took a pack, didn't we? We all got one. I think we all.
No,
one.
I didn't.
At least two of us.
No.
Did.
No.
So that should have gone in your museum, man, because that's some scary swag.
Yeah,
I don't know how that would look next to the Phantasm Sphere and the Lucille from Walking Dead bat.
Right. Yes. Yeah. What Michael, yeah, one day he will charge admission for tours of his work level. But oh man, it was cool. But so how are things in New York? Because you are you're calling a bit, you are a bit away from where we are, our region at least. What's
what's going on up there?
Yeah, you
know, it's north of the wall up here, you know. And but of course, you know, I moved to upstate New York to so you know so that I'd have a warmer spring. Being from Maine originally, so you know, usually we get one, but not this year. But you know, it's if you like the snowy woods and you like the you know the mountains and the waters, this is a good place to be. But you pay the price this time of year.
Right.
But that's what's up. It'll be good. It'll be you know that the trout will be around a little longer. The water will be a little colder. That's all right.
Well, you are always doing cool stuff. I was just showing Holly's daughter's boyfriend, Raymond, the other day. I was showing him your gallery of photos because I was going to prove to him that you did, in fact, look like Dave Grohl. And he did confirm that, yes, you do. And but, you know, he was like, he's doing all this manly stuff in every picture, you know. And, you know, showing you, like, throw, you know, holding logs or playing guitars. And doing, I mean, you just had have fun up there. I swear to God.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I'm like the city boy compared to the ancestors up in Maine. Those guys are hardcore. You know, we throw a few logs around and shoot the rifles and hook a fish and have bonfires. But, you know, those guys are 24/7 up there. It's pretty funny. But yeah, we have a good time. And
yeah. Your gallery is a blast to look through. It's fun.
Yeah. That all is coming up. Yeah, we're gonna have a little bit of an extended time up on the lake this year, where my dad's cabin is. We only usually stay a few days, but this year we're gonna go up a little longer. That should be fun. I'm really looking forward to taking a paddle. That lake is still pretty empty. There's electricity on one side of it now. When I was a kid, there was none really, you couldn't drive in. You had to either boat. You could drive to one lake, take a boat across a couple to get there to the cabin, or you could drive to a road and then hike in, but you really couldn't get there from anywhere. And so this year we're going back, and I'm looking forward to it. I think particularly this year because you know the new book I'm working on is about it's about a group of hunters who encounter a werewolf cult. So I'm really boning up on sort of like the aesthetics of being in the woods for an extended period of time. You know, Slash of Crimson was kind of an urban novel, kind of an urban fantasy, even though, I mean, it's on the coast of Maine and there's some scenes on the ocean, but it's really, really more of an urban novel. But this next book I'm working on, I'm pretty excited about. And so I'm going to be spending even more time than usual outdoors and in the woods to work on Red December and feel like what it's like to be among the trees and possibly the wolves.
So it'd be like a Dave Grohl looking protagonist throwing logs at werewolves kind of story, or are we going a different direction?
Yeah, well, you know, who knows? Maybe he could be like Dave Grohl. We could go with Gaul from Gorgoroth, or we could, you know, who knows? We could have right. a hybrid Yngwie Malmsteen Dave Grohl. Werewolf
hey,
fighter.
And I got into Malmsteen quote to introduce you. That's
right.
Some art right there.
That's why I got Malmsteen on the brain.
Yeah.
Fury.
Next time I'll save his quote about donuts for next time. I'll save the donut quote for next visit.
There we go. Either way.
Less is not more.
Well, you
more
know.
Is more. Yeah.
Exactly. Right,
but you brought
well, you
up.
You know, he's a quotable guy.
Oh God, yes, he's a character, that's for sure. And now yeah. He thinks of you know he's going to be his permanent. He is going to sing now on everything going forward. And I'm like, oh my God, Yngwie is hitting a new level of uniqueness. But
you can't
yes,
say things like that while I'm on my first bourbon.
Yes,
Yngwie Malmsteen singing is the second bourbon conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, when I think of Jeff Scott Soto and Mark Bowles and Jolynn Turner, it just makes me cry. It's like, oh,
right.
I remember those days, but Oh, well, it's kind of hard to get through to Yngwie, I think, but as far as constructive criticism.
Well, you know, I think of him more as, he's a technical guitarist, and he's fun in his own way. I was never huge on that bandwagon. I was more of a death metal guy.
Yeah. But you are a top level talent, and you are good to work with, and I do want to segue off your comment about Slash of Crimson and other tales, which has crime noir, alt mythology, and horror tales all in one collection, with a badass cover by none other than Aaron Drown,
which had a change of guitars on it.
Yeah, we did have a change of guitars, and I do want you to tell that story. But
funny because he's Aaron Drown was a smart guy. He had the right vision when we were working on that, and I was describing the band, and actually it was kind of funny because he was like, "Oh, it's a horror story about a heavy metal band, right?" But he's like, "Oh, what kind of guitar does the guitarist play?" And I realize I talk a lot about his solos, but it's not so much about his guitar. And I'm like, "Oh, really? You know, you have carte blanche because we don't really name his magic guitar. It's not really about the guitar so much, but it is about the band." So I was like, "You can pretty much pick any kind of guitar, but they are a hard rock band." So he was like, "All right."
Yeah.
So he, you know, sent me a draft of the cover, and it was completely awesome. And I was totally blown away by the image of the demon flying away in the back, the succubus, and the sort of the red haze over the ocean just blew me away. But I was, I was like, we got to have the naked chick on the cover. I mean, right? Isn't that what you're supposed to do? But like,
of course.
But then he was like, no. And you know, he had the right artistic sense, I think, there as the visual artist. He's like, you know, we're gonna have that on the back. You know, it folds out, and we're gonna have the guitar. And I said, "Oh, well, you know, by the way, also the guitar on the cover, he had originally put, it looked like it was a kind of a Stratocaster, you know, with a red and white
Stratocaster.
Yeah. And, with a sort of blonde, like a maple neck, and it was a cool looking guitar, but you know, I don't know if any of you guys played in rock bands back in the day at all, but like when I was a lad, there was a certain kind of guitar you could get, you know, when you were 13 called a Fender Bullet that looked like a Strat, but it was called a Bullet. It was sort of a starter guitar, and it was red and white, a lot like the red and white Strat in the picture. So there was that angle on it immediately for me. And on top of that, Strats are more of like sort of a, I think of them as a 60s or 70s sort of psychedelic rock guitar. I associate them a bit with like Woodstock and sort of that kind of Jimi Hendrix and that kind of, you know, I mean, there's some fusion jazz and the rest, but like, but basically, I was like, I didn't feel like Strat matched the mood of the urban horror story. So I was like, look, the cover is so awesome. I wasn't sure what to say, but I was like, I was so blown away by it. But I was like, I feel like the only thing that if I were going to change something, the only thing I would change would be the guitar. And you know, mostly because these guys are a hard rock band. And I kind of said to him what I had just said now. And I said, what about like a Dean or a metal guitar? And Aaron was like, and I think wisely, he said, you know, I don't want to put like a super crazy metal guitar, like a Dimebag Darrell kind of thing on there, because it'll sort of maybe pigeonhole the story a bit and narrow the audience where you might have a wider appeal with something that's not like the sort of super specific
metal.
Metal guitar. Yeah. And I think he was absolutely right. And so, And I was so blown away by his overall work that I was like, well, geez, I don't really have a very sharp editorial pen here when it comes to this visual stuff. But I did kind of Google around and realized that you know what guitar sort of spans hard rock and metal and has been like the respected icon of that elusive genre hard rock as opposed to metal, and that's a Gibson SG. You know, because Angus Young plays one of those, you know, and that's really like AC/DC, sort of like that like border of rock and metal sort of band. And back in the day, like, you know, I mean, the Doors had one of those, but like it was always kind of a spooky sort of mood of a guitar, but definitely respected by by both rockers and metal fans. So so I kind of Googled around, and I think I picked a black SG to email to him. But he latched onto it right away, and he was like, oh, you're right, an SG is cool. I mean, let's face it, it's got the little horn shape on the body, right?
Oh,
yeah,
can you go wrong? Yeah.
It's got the horns, you know, he picked the Cherry SG, the 68 SG. And I have a good friend who's got an original 68 SG, who's a professional musician who uses that as his main guitar. And I thought it was hilarious because, like, when I emailed my buddy, I was like, I remember when we were like kids, he started out on a Fender Bullet, but now he's got this 68 SG. And I was like, wow, we started out with your old guitar, but now we got your new guitar. Which is a 68 SG, and it's pretty awesome. So I really appreciate what Aaron Trout did with all that.
Aaron does have some good hard rock sensibilities. I mean, he does have good, he does know the hard rock world. So that was really cool that he had the nuance of suggesting the SG. The irony is, and this is gonna make you chuckle. Yngwie is a Fender Strat guy.
Exactly. You're exactly. That's right. Yngwie is a Strat guy. That's so funny. Yeah.
It's a little more irony tonight.
Completely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh,
Strats
Lord.
Are great guitars. You know, they're, you know, it's just interesting to watch how the history evolved for the different instruments.
Oh, most
different
definitely.
Genres.
And we'll say, give a shout out to Robert Osborne in the chat room, and Holly Philippi is raising some mayhem in there, and things are just getting maybe warmed up in there. Hopefully we'll get a question or two for you later, but let's segue from the cover to the interior. Let's go to the tales of Slash of Crimson and Other Tales. So you can, you know, get in a little bit of that for those that may not be familiar with your book yet.
Sure. Well, the novella Slash of Crimson kind of like had its own life. You know, I mean, I had worked on various novels and stories and was trying to get different projects in gear. And Slash of Crimson started out, I published with Armand Rosamilia. And he actually noticed, he's like, this is kind of a cool story. I'm into this. Let's do it. And that went okay. And that was cool. It was a cool small press publication. But what's interesting about Slash of Crimson is the way it kind of like grew on its own when I wasn't necessarily, I didn't have it at the forefront for the stuff I was working on. But then it kind of moved into front and center because of the attention it got around with some of the people in the small press world. And once it got to the point where I was working with Margie Colton on the sort of director's cut that I've got published with Seventh Star Press in Slash of Crimson and Other Tales, it really gained steam. Working with Margie, like, she was kind of like really helped me open up the story, and it made me realize that really the strength of the story is it's really a story about mistaken identity, two characters who are in desperate circumstances, a young person kind of struggling living in this sort of noirish coastal city, and sort of struggling in their young life to try to get ahead with their art, and also economically struggling. So you have this young character, and then you have Sandra Deeps, the woman who he meets when he has his kayak accident, and she's a fugitive, really. She's a fugitive. So it's really a story of a young person who's a struggling artist and a relationship with somebody who's a fugitive and whose identity is a mystery. And when I was editing it with Margie and talking about these concepts, I feel like we really breathed new life into it. And I sort of deepened and expanded the identities of these two characters. And I think we really brought out a fun read, and I feel like it, like a song where the melody just falls into place. It really kind of leapt out full form, and in as the title novella for the book we've got today.
Yeah, Margie's awesome. I mean, I really can't say enough about her ability as an editor, and so that was actually one of the things that, you know, before I even knew you, that I was like, oh, this, I bet you this is gonna be good, just because I knew that she was, you know, working with you on that project, and And so, yeah, it's editors. Yeah, they definitely are a big part of our equation as authors, and good ones can really make a difference when they have those kind of insights. But
yeah, I can't thank her enough. I mean, I feel like she knew exactly what the role of an editor is supposed to be. You know, it was something where she was looking at the existing story and trying to tease out, like, sort of the existing story. She focused on the language. We would send back and forth these black lines, and we would talk about the scenes that we could include, the scenes that we could cut, and we did it in a way that was really like working on, you know, on a craft, like building a boat or building a house together, and really just looking at it and kind of shaving off a piece here and adding a piece there. And it really, I feel like because she knew exactly what an editor does, it allowed me to bring out the best possible story.
And then the fun, once you get it out, the work begins. All of that, then the work begins.
Yeah.
So, and you and Daniel are almost like siblings in the sense that both of you had, you know, within a month or two of each other. I can't remember exactly, but yeah, a couple months of each other. Both of you were, you know, hit the ground with new books last year. And so both of you in a sense, have gotten to see the joys and the fun and the glory of the indie author world that Michael and I have
been,
you know, indulging in so much over the last few years. But, yeah, give us some thoughts about, you know, pros, cons, eye openers, things you're surprised,
absolutely,
you know, that kind of thing.
Well, I feel like I'm very, like, supply side when it comes to this. In other words, most of my time when I kind of moved from spending a lot of time playing music to writing, past decade or so, a little more. But point being, you know, back in the day, I had read Stephen King's On Writing. I think a lot about the writing. I think about the stories. I think about the novels. I make sure I write every day the way an athlete works out every day. I do everything I can to make the stories exciting and interesting, and that's the craft, and that's where my focus most of the time is. One of the things that I think was conspicuously absent because of the time it was written from a book like Stephen King's On Writing was the promotion side. So I feel like for me, the writing is something that I keep very sharp, and I actually feel like there are aspects of the promoting that come very naturally to me. I'll talk a little more about that in a minute. But there are other parts, things like, well, it's sort of like being in a band. You know, you can have a good local band and be playing in your bars and so forth. But a tour can be a hard thing to put together. If people have day jobs, for example, if people have families, those kinds of things. If you're going to go on a tour with your band, you know, across the country, how do you put that together when you've got these other things going on? I think that writing is more like that. Writing in the indie world is like that. And it's something that I think is talked about more now maybe than it used to be. You know, like back, you know, maybe in the 80s and 90s, particularly, you know, like then it was, you mailed away your manuscript, you hoped you got it good. People kind of like either accepted it, gave you advance and promoted it, or they didn't. And now, you know, it's more like being in the music world. You are expected to have your band. You kind of have your band. You get that whole package together. You move around.
Mm-hmm.
You gain a following. And then once you have your following, then you might be able to take another step to bigger resources. But I would say, yeah, I would say if there's any theme for the indie world, for me, it's that it's a lot more like playing in a band than I originally thought. But that's a cool thing, too. And the upside of that is one thing that I feel like does come naturally is I have this blog, Crimes of Heaven and Hell, which I've sort of begun to merge with the Seventh Star blog, where I do these book reviews, and I've been doing them for a very long time. And when I first started my blog, I noticed, like, it wasn't getting, like, tons of hits, but for something that was reviewing books, I would get, you know, I was getting hits from all over, like, Canada and stuff. Like, I was like, I don't know anybody there, you know, I was getting a lot of hits on my book reviews particularly. And I was doing it sort of for fun, but also to promote my own work, of course. And so then eventually I did this one review of Jack Ketchum's Off Season, which a website in the UK kind of picked up as a best of horror for the week back in September a couple of years ago. And so the blog was getting like 100 hits a minute for a couple of days. And I was like, that's crazy. You know, I had written an essay about the difference between Ketchum's novel taking place in Maine and the aesthetic of Stephen King's novels in Maine. And I sort of wove it in with a biography about what it was like to go to my dad's cabin, which is kind of located near where Off Season takes place. So at any rate, point being, I've really started having fun with the book review side of my blog at www.carlrmoore.com or crimesofheavenandhell.com, where I've got this whole archive. At the time, I was calling it Is That an Old Book? Because I had gone to a bookstore one day, and I was asking about a novel from a writer I knew back in New York City who wrote sort of like crime noir, drug addiction novels. His name was Tony O'Neill, and I was asking about a book by him, and I was standing in this, it was actually an indie bookstore, but it's here in Albany, and I was asking the person at the counter if they had the book, and she said, I don't know, I don't think so. Is that an old book? And I wanted to reply, cause it was like 3 years old, right? I was like, an old book? I was like, I wanted to say, like, you know, the Iliad is an old book, right? You know, the Icelandic sagas are old books. The Bible is an old book. Like, you know, like, this book came out 3 years ago. So the point of my blog, in part, was that I was going to review books that did not necessarily just come out or about to come out, like you often get in magazines, but I was going to, you know, pick up a novel from, you know, pick up a William Gibson novel from the 90s, or pick up, you know, an indie author novel, you know, like, or pick up a Ralph James White novel, you know, from the aughts, and just write about it, because it's just as cool a book now as it was when it first came out. So at any rate, so that side of the promoting for me did come naturally, and I've been having fun with that. And now I feel like I'm just starting to raise the sail for this new series, review series, Author's Own Words, where I've got one, the most recent one was with Sarah Bauer, and I'm going to keep my fingers crossed. I've got another one coming up pretty soon, although I haven't asked the author yet, so I'm not going to announce it, but this combines a review with an interview with the author. Oh, and of course I had one with Daniel, right, Daniel?
Yep.
Exactly. I had a great one with Daniel Dark. Yeah, right. Which worked out great. So that combines the book review with the interview, and so I hope to do more of those. So that side of like indie author and promoting comes quite naturally. Of course, that's also easier to manage because your tour is virtual, right? You're online.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
So you don't need a tour bus or airplane.
That's true. It's just, you know, the thing about today is, and I always like to talk about this, is like, can you even imagine like Tolkien or C.S. Lewis having a Twitter account? I mean, it's really a different world entirely. I mean, for a lot of us authors, I mean, we have to. It's not like we can avoid these things that are out there. And it's like, I hate your authors. Oh, I hate Facebook. Oh, I hate this one. But you have to. I mean, in order to make progress, I mean, you have to, you know, embrace some of that stuff, and, you know, even if you don't enjoy it a whole lot. But the thing is it's, you know, the problem is that in the digital age, it's truly a saturated market that you're fighting against. I mean, just in sheer volume. And that's not a criticism of any authors in particular. It's just a, you know, supply and demand dynamic. And that's the thing that I think is very difficult for the new authors that are coming into it. And I think that's where, you know, I think that guys like you and I think Daniel Dark and Michael does it really well, though. It's like, when you guys get in front of people, I mean, you guys really do connect well. And that's, I think definitely your background as a musician, performer, I think obviously it could help in that area of doing events and you know, panels and all that other stuff. And but it's a rough road because – you really do have to, you know, do that kind of thing.
I mean, I think when you're serious about what you're doing, it shows when you care about the craft, whether it's music or writing, it shows when you're doing it. And, you know, on the upside of the saturation issue, one thing I think is interesting and another analog to the music world, you know, so like, you know, CD sales aren't the main income for bands anymore, right? So live
right.
performances are more critical than they were in the 70s and 80s, 60s, 70s, 80s, what have you, 90s even.
Yeah,
it's kind of like come back to the live show as the prime income and the prime presence of any given musician, and you sell recordings at your show. But you know, of course, on the internet, it's really hard not to keep your music from being free in one form or another. People can pirate it, or people usually just post it to promote themselves. So like, you know, in the music world now, like it. But you know, the interesting thing to my mind about that is, it's not so much that things have gone to the way they were to the way they are now. The way I think of it more is that things have gone back to the way they were before. So I think of it as, if you look at like musicians, like anywhere from like the Middle Ages to the Victorian age to the early 20th century, when you were going around with a blues guitar playing at juke joints, you know, you started getting recording income, and I guess in the first half of the 20th century, but there were a lot of impoverished, fantastic musicians. I mean, Robert Johnson was barely getting by, you know, like he was hoping to make it millions with records, but he died, you know, in kind of obscurity in this hellhound sort of situation. Right. But the point is that he was a live performer most of his career. We've got his recordings, but like back in the day, you really had to be able to perform live, and you had to be able to be that artist, you had to be able to do it live, and you weren't necessarily gonna survive just on a hit or a sales figure right away. I mean, think about it, you know, if you really want to get ancient, and that's what I often like to do, you know, what were scalds, what were bards, what were people doing in the oral tradition, you know? You showed up at a hall, and if you couldn't entertain the Lord, they threw you out to Grendel, and that was that. I feel like the upside of the saturation is that it's kind of come back to, as you were saying, the ability to sort of to like walk the walk, and if you can create something that people enjoy, and you can promote it in person or make it live and breathe in person, then you begin to have a presence, and in the case with books, you'll sell more books that way as well.
Well, we'll start working on making your first audiobook available only in wax cylinder, then, just to keep a kind of an older world setting kind of on it.
I'll keep
you close to Daniel's age with the Victorian era, so it'll work out
exactly,
well for
yeah.
all involved. I know what you mean. Yeah, definitely. Things have never been more technological, but at the same time, it's like we're, you know, a lot of things are retro now, and it's kind of an interesting, unpredictable kind of environment right now. It's strange.
Yeah. Well, I think, on another positive, you know, having the ability to sell your stuff online so that if you do make a good impression in person, or if your blog does something well, people can immediately buy your product. You know, they can click and buy it. That helps to not necessarily have to only do it out of the back of your car.
That's true.
Definitely an upside.
But then you face the dynamic where they think like, oh my God, you know, you're asking for, you know, 99 cents for a book or dollar. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, things are really tight right now. Then like 3 hours later, you'll see and post a picture on Facebook, you know, at Starbucks drinking a $6 latte. You're like, oh. Man, really?
Exactly.
You know,
no, that's, my, yeah, that's a crime.
Yeah, I'm really not that expensive.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah.
So I think perception of value is probably one of the things that I'm most, be candid, frustrated about with the modern book world. It's, you know, people just, you know, they don't, they, well, I think it, musicians get it too. Filmmakers get it too. Since everything's moved to a digital format, I think the perception of value in each of the mediums spheres there is, it's definitely hurt. You know, and it's,
yeah,
you know, they don't look at it the same way they did when the mediums were tangible, as in a physical book or a piece of vinyl or whatnot. And I think that's affected a lot of things, you know, in terms of the economics of the book world.
Yeah. I mean, I think you definitely have more experience with that than I do, as this is my first book. But I am noticing straight away that there are some people who have Kindles and who are, when I promote the book and they say they'll buy a copy, they download it. But I think I'm definitely selling more paperbacks and have an easier time. People want the paperback. Mm-hmm. You know, it's almost like it's like getting vinyl, and it's a cool thing, and people enjoy the aesthetic of the paperback in that way, you know, in itself an object of beauty, which is, again, why, you know, when you have someone like Aaron Drown doing the cover, that helps make it that object that that people want to buy.
Right.
As a physical object.
Yes. And it's a kind of a brave new world in a lot of ways, and they you know, always they're throwing curveballs at you, like the development of things like Kindle Unlimited, and of course BookBub becoming
right.
like a major force in the industry, and this and all these things that you kind of have to, you know, play the game with anymore, and it's it can be a little head spinning for a newer author, for sure, or even a longtime author. I mean, I know Michael
sure.
and I are scratching our heads often, you know, and we've been around not you know, a ton of years in, as far as being published, but it's definitely we've seen a lot of things change just in the time we've
yeah.
been around, and it's definitely it's a challenge.
Yeah.
Well, Michael saw him go from chisel to computer, didn't he?
No, but I did do my first novel on floppy disks at the college computer lab.
That's awesome.
Nice.
That's
I remember,
fantastic.
Yeah, I remember the little 3-inch floppies.
What? No,
see,
these were the full, like
5 and a quarter.
Five and a quarter.
Right, looks like
yeah,
a 45
trying
floppy
to brag,
record,
Michael.
Like.
I
don't think that's
those,
bragging.
Those five and a quarter.
Your floppy's not any bigger than anybody else's floppy.
That's not bragging. That's branding me a dinosaur.
Yeah. They were actually floppy, though. Yeah, I mean,
they
were.
They were.
It's floppy. I don't think it matters if it's 3 inches or 5 inches.
But they fit nicely
oh,
in
no.
the hard drive.
Sorry.
We need
we're getting
Kenzie
to that second
Michaels
bourbon.
This part of the
we can talk about Ingvy Malmsteen now.
Oh, I'll see the light tonight for sure. There you
that's
go.
Right.
Oh man, but that's a good anecdote there. But yeah, it definitely has. I mean, shifted a lot, and it's who knows? I mean, I've definitely seen. I think more people. It's almost like the vinyl resurgence, though. I've seen more people starting to slowly return to tangible books. Which is kind of cool. I mean, I'm kind of stoked
yeah.
about that. You know, at the same time, you know, it's not big enough of a return that I think that it's going to save the big box kind of chains that there were in the past, like your Borders chains and things like that. But I think it definitely could kind of balance out a little bit better for authors if you know, it becomes more of a tangible reader market as far as the product itself. But,
well, you can
right.
see that it's helped out some when Amazon is thinking about, you know, having their own bookstores and stuff now. So.
Yeah. You know,
yeah.
I walked by one of those in New York City on the way to work in Midtown. And I haven't gone in yet. It looks, you know, continuing on this riff, it does look a little bit like a combination of a record store and a bookstore and an old Blockbusters.
Nice.
Maybe because of the yellow. I don't know. Yeah,
I have to admit, I kind of geek out when I've actually come across the rare actual DVD video store, you know, that actually still,
right.
you know, rents DVDs. And there's just something cool about that. And you know, when you come across a store like you're talking about, yeah, that's fun. I mean, I love browsing those kind of stores for sure.
Definitely. I miss the abundance of old bookstores. It was one of the things that made me want to, that in conjunction with telling stories, wanted me to get into writing books. I mean, there used to be three or four here in Albany that were just amazing. The kind that were like, you know, you walked in, you were walking into a labyrinth. There was usually some version of a grumpy old or grumpy young book man or lady, you know, ready to like, you know, treat your right or wrong. It was luck of the draw, but it was part of the adventure. And you would wend your way in, and you'd find some really cool book, you know, by the time you were out, or two or 10, you know, each had their own character. You know, you could have one that was sort of like the sci-fi nerd with the yellowed old copies of Asimov's or whatever. And then you would have another one, which was sort of like the beatnik place that smelled like burnt espresso and had jazz playing. Like, you had all the different used bookstores, and I don't know of many left. And not only that, but
if you come down here, Carl, I will introduce you to one.
All right.
One of the greatest bookstores that you'll ever walk into.
I'm excited about that, and we'll add that to the list of what's sure going to be an adventure involving Tennessee whiskey, bluegrass bookstores, Daniel Dark in Nashville, and Carl R. Moore.
Well, Lexington, I'm getting this game here. Joseph Beth Booksellers in Lexington is spectacular, and it is an amazing independent bookstore. It's massive too, but it's right here in the heart of Lexington, Kentucky, and we will show you that when you hit Lexington. So.
Yeah, oh no,
sure.
That'll be fun. I'm into all of it. You know, I mean, you have the famous ones, you know, the Strand and City Lights and the big cities, and those places are cool. You know, like, and I've definitely hung out in those places. When I was living in Portland, Maine, we had a lot of really great ones. In fact, probably most of my time that I really spent hanging out in used bookstores was in Portland, Maine. During the time that Splash of Crimson references, when it was only half kind of rebuilt and still sort of had this old Lovecraftian coastal city vibe to it. You know, it had all these great bookstores. But most of those, to my knowledge, are gone now as well.
Well, by the time you get to Lexington, there will be Lovecraftian creatures, because Holly's gotten into these things called air plants. And what they are is actually baby Cthulhu monsters that she's been growing.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I saw those photos on your page.
We'll show you Lovecraftian. We'll help you there.
Nice. Nice.
I'm going to slew them.
Do you have an Audrey?
Did she get them during a total eclipse of the sun?
She probably did. She's in the chat room, so I'll see what she says here. Oh, they're actually discussing coyotes in the chat room. But the cats are safe. Robert Osborne has a bunch of coyotes coming through his backyard, but the cats are on the porch, so they are safe.
See,
there's a lot of excitement going on in the chat room here. It's good to know the cats are safe.
Every time I let my dog out, I'm always like standing guard because I'm afraid some coyote's going to come up and snatch him.
No, they are no fun. Holly is telling her story about her potbelly pig got killed, actually, because they teamed up to dig underneath a fence where she had it, and she was pregnant at the time, so she wasn't able to do anything about it, unfortunately. But they're not fun. But
you got to watch those coyotes. I've been followed by coyotes on a number of occasions, usually on hunting trips. And,
we've got
you know,
Kentucky,
they
so we can show you a few of those for sure.
you got your little ones, and you got your like coy wolves, you know, and you got your the big ones, and they can.
Oh,
be
I know how to lure
lot.
You down here. We've got elk in Kentucky. Is that impressive?
You don't need to lure me down there. You guys got bourbon. You've had it. Like,
yes,
no worries.
We got that all over the place. Yeah,
distilleries
everywhere, and more opening all the time.
it was a great time coming down there, and I'm making every effort to make that happen again this year. I'm thinking it is very likely that it will. I think that this year I would be looking forward to spending even more time in the panel discussions. And I didn't even get into any of the movie events and the film discussions.
Right.
I'd like to check that out more too.
We got a guy that you'll love, Christopher St. Booth. I mean, he's a, guy that's a personality on the Sci-Fi Channel quite a bit. And it's he's a filmmaker. He's an author. He's a musician. I mean, it's insane how many talents he has. But he's a down-to-earth, just absolutely lovely British guy, and really, really sweet guy. And Holly just adores him. She's got to know him better than I have at this point. But I think you will click with him for sure this year. It's gonna be fun to watch you hang out,
because
he's long year kind of vibe for sure. But he's we got a lot of good film people coming in. Lots of good film people coming in. We've been trying to definitely bring a few more in that area. And it's gonna be a fun year, I think. And Imaginarium alone, you should just come to witness the convergence of Peter Welmerink, Stephen L. Shrewsbury, and Bob Freeman. When those three come together, it could be apocalyptic. I mean, that is I have wanted to put that trio together for a few years now, and finally it has happened. That alone is reason for you to come here.
That sounds exciting. I mean, Mr. Shrewsbury alone is pretty impressively apocalyptic in a great way. He was on the other side of me. I was next to Daniel at the table last year, and I was also next to Stephen Shrewsbury. And in fact, I am reading King of the Bastards right now. What a wicked fun book that is, right? What a wicked fun book.
Yeah.
I mean, like,
that's, oh my God.
It's
if you've read Brian Keene, you know, and know, you know, the glee with which he can describe all forms of dismemberment. And then you get
exactly
you team him up with Shrews, that, you know, who is the reincarnation of Howard, you know.
Right. Definitely a Robert E. Howard vibe, but also like it's cool because it's got this very, very like contemporary feel to the prose. It's like Howard in digital color, you know, but like with his own cool. What's really impressive, and this is going to get in my review, I don't want to foreshadow it too much, but like it's impressive how he has his own sort of, he's got his own trademark sort of sets of verbs and adjectives and his system of nomenclature that on the one hand echoes like folks like Howard and Martin, George R. R. Martin and Lovecraft, but yet on the other hand it's completely his own style, you know, like that's not actually like, you know, duplicating those. And so I'm really getting into his alternate sort of semi-European history fantasy world, you know, and it's also very fast moving. So good times. I'm definitely going to read more, but I recommend you highly.
Shrews has an icon character in Garias Lagal, and that's the character that stars in his novels Thrall, Overkill, Born of Swords, and his short story collection, Blood and Steel, Legends of Lagal. And it's, oh my God. I mean, I'm a huge Howard fan. And so, I mean, I just fell in love with Shrews's, you know, whole thing with Garias Lagal, like immediately. And, definitely. I mean, if you get some time later, after, and I know you got a lot on your plate, but check out some of his, Garias Lagal stuff.
Oh,
it's amazing.
I can go through this stuff the way I can go through bourbon. There's always time for it, you know. And I'm looking forward to definitely reading more of his novels. Another fantasy writer I'm going to check out soon will be Stephen Zimmer. I know that. I guess.
I don't know who that is yet, but I'm
well, there's all this cool sort of fantasy stuff going on, and I mostly read sort of horror and classics, but then like I've been drifting back towards fantasy lately. So I'm really excited to get into some of your stuff and some of the other great stuff I see around in that genre.
Well, see, I set out on a mission to show Michael West that yes, I can actually write horror. Yeah. My hellscapes short stories.
Right.
I can do it. It's possible.
Nice.
But I think you'll get a kick out of those too. So at some point, yeah, because they are a little more macabre and visceral, and you know, you know, to kind of describe this, the style of it, but a lot of fun because I grew up on Barker and Dante's Inferno and all kinds of stuff like that. And unfortunately it's,
good
I don't
stuff.
Have to get a full throttle on that stuff in the fantasy, but in those short stories I do. So it's, and that's kind of a fun exploration. And that's what I love about doing what we do. It's like with Michael's, you know, ability, you know, like I said, he's a great horror author, but in when he did the Legacy of the God series, he got to, you know, expand into, you know, other areas, you know, with, you know, in urban fantasy flavors and things like that, and science fiction even. And it's so cool about today's world as authors that we do get to play in more genres than an author of, say, you know, 25 years ago or something like that. It's very cool. There's a little bit more breathing room to experiment in different genres.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I feel like that's, it's almost like, you know, crossing two genres is sort of an art in itself. And they're, you know, I know that like for like crime fiction, you know, like that's been one of the most popular sort of genres to cross with another genre. Like, you know, I think what was it the back in the day before it became so popular when they were first, I don't know, like early on when Game of Thrones was getting pitched. I don't know if it was getting pitched or sold with a byline for HBO, and they were calling it The Godfather meets Lord of the Rings. So like the concept being like, you know, like crime noir mysteries being mixed with fantasy, being mixed with horror, being mixed with any of the supernatural genres. Yeah. So that's interesting. And, you know, the interview I did with Sarah Bauer recently, you know, her Bite Somebody novel is definitely like a sort of like a paranormal romance, or almost like urban chick lit like romance book mixed with like massive like vampire brawls with blood and fangs. And it was actually pretty fun and pretty funny because of the mix aspect of it. So yeah,
right.
So that cross genre is really happening. And it's almost like you have some, it's almost like sometimes you see folks very deliberately trying to mix two genres because so much of it blends, you know. You might have like, you know, say wizards in the Old West or something. And so you try to keep it kind of straight with the, like, you know, magic, but then a straight up Old West world, as opposed to like, you know, there are others that sort of just go ahead and blend horror, fantasy and crime fiction without being specific about the categories.
That's true. Yeah. And Weird Western. That's a fun subgenre too, for sure.
Yeah.
And, but I love the mishmashes for sure. And then I love it too when somebody can, you know, come right back to their, you know, a core, like the meat and potatoes kind of genre, and really crank something with a little bit of a fresh stamp on it or twist, you know. And that's always something really cool to sink your teeth into.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
But it's
I'm a fan of historical fiction because of that.
Oh yes. Yes.
A certain authenticity and a certain ability to control the aesthetic to create a mood.
Yeah, and I noticed that a lot of historical fiction too even dances on the edge of, you know, kind of having little subtle speculative fiction elements in it.
Sure.
It's kind of fun to see that percolating on the edge.
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, The Terror comes to mind, which is now novel The Terror, Simmons' novel, but it's also now a TV series on AMC. But like the, you know, the Franklin expedition trapped, you know, that cannibalized one another trying to find the Northwest Passage, and they throw in a Cthulhu type monster, you know, speculating like, you know, the whole crew disappeared. We know that they ate each other, but then you can sort of like, the author's able to like, you know, weave in this supernatural creature.
Right.
Attacking the sailors, right? Yeah, yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, that was...
exactly.
Oh, God. What was that movie that you... Oh, God. I saw it, and you love it. Oh my God, it's on Netflix and it's killing me right now. I can't remember. It's a Scandinavian movie.
The Ritual?
Oh shoot. That's it.
The Ritual?
Yes, with the kind of Norse god still existing kind of thing.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good. It had pros and cons. I had like two good movie buff friends I have. One loved it, one hated it, and I kind of agreed with both of them. But one of my blog tour pieces, which I don't think made it up, which I might put back in with a review of The Ritual, or talked a lot about The Ritual, talking about how much you reveal a monster in a given story,
right,
and how. Yeah, The Ritual, it sort of had like a Blair Witch aspect to it in that there was just like a long period of tension. But then in the last half an hour, they really let you have it.
The only thing I didn't like about it is just the protagonists are all wimps.
I couldn't agree more. That's exactly where I was headed. That's where I was like, who the hell are these guys? Like,
Holly remembers me cussing at the TV about how wimpy they were.
They really were. That was my one friend who was like, these guys can't pitch a tent. I was, first of all, jealous that they got to hang out for 3 weeks in Sweden on vacation. Who gets to do that? And then, and then they can't deal with it. Like, I mean, I related to the guy who wanted to get a beer, but to do that, you know, after you've like brawled with the monster with, you know, a Bowie knife and a shoestring, like, what's the matter with you, man?
Has Mr. Horror Movie seen that yet? Michael West, have you seen The Ritual?
It's on my list, but I haven't watched it yet.
Definitely worth seeing. As soon as you can.
Yeah.
Totally worth seeing.
Yeah, the real weakness was the characters. It was such a good movie aesthetically.
With the monster design was awesome too. I'm not going to spoil or anything, but oh god, the monster design is so killer cool and weird.
I agree. That's what made me all the more angry about the character development. I feel like they were trying to do something about the guy's guilt because he didn't jump the guy in the robbery. But when I feel like how many bad nights I've had in New York City, and I feel like that situation, I'm like, geez, man, I was like, or not even bad nights, but crazy nights, I should say. But I'm like, you can't like throw down for your buddy when the liquor store is getting robbed. What is wrong? Like, anyway.
Oh, I know. I mean, like, I know me, and I've been in situations where I haven't even hesitated to come to my friend's help. You know, I mean, that's just like not even a thought. And that's the only thing I'm just irked me to no end about those guys. And it's like, yeah, some of that element, you know, because I mean, the whole group kind of had that, you know, kind of hesitancy about them, but it's like, I don't want to give Michael too many spoilers, because by the time watches it, he'll have a life size version of the monster in his basement. He will. I know it. He'll be added to his collection.
Yeah, man. Yeah, good stuff.
But way cool stuff. But oh man, so what is coming up with you as far as? Well, you gave me this hint about what your current writing project is, but what's coming up with you?
Yeah, I gave you the little lead up on Red December, which is the one I feel like has legs. The old hunter dealing with werewolves in his backyard. But, you know, it's also very much about a small town sort of trying to survive in the Catskills. And you know, it's really like there's a lot of states like this, you know, these old industrial towns that are kind of looking for a new direction. But at the same time, the wild country around it is also beautiful and empty. So like you've got there's a dynamic where you have this kind of old hunter, and it's really kind of about the characters. He's dealing with these strange creatures with his hunting group, but he's also kind of in a place in life. He's sort of middle aged. His wife's an accountant. He kind of wants a family. She doesn't. She's content with her career. And he's sort of like, they're starting to sort of drift apart at the novel's opening. And in the meantime, he's got this kind of neighbor who lives over the mountain who used to own a tavern in a town. And these sort of shiesty lawyers conned him out of his tavern and most of his land. So he stays in his trailer and drinks too much. And then he starts hanging around in this cave, and they start saying rumors that he worships a wolf skull. And, then there's the hunter Cade, he takes these groups in the town. In the fall, he sort of volunteers. He takes sort of like people, he sort of guides people without a lot of hunting experience, and he also takes at-risk youth, and he takes them on this one group hunting trip for a weekend on his land. And it just happens to be a weekend that this cult of mutant wolves attack the development where the tavern used to be, and devour half its population and enslave the rest on the mountain. And the only people in the town that are sort of not in the town when the wolves attack are the people who are hunting. So there becomes this sort of standoff between the hunters and this wolf cult. And thrown into, so it's like, so, and there's a little bit of a theme, like, you know, you're not sure if it's, the guy who lost his land and quote unquote worships the wolf skull without spoiling it. He has a certain motive, and his group these mutant wolves have their own way of looking at things. So you have this standoff, and of course when the feds arrive to surround the place, they sort of they give the hunters an ultimatum: either you can save your town, or we can just mop everybody up and blame you guys for being a nutcase gun cult.
This is awesome.
So it's really about this one small town sort of like property or hunter guy, and then his neighbor who's kind of down on his luck and decides to go off the deep end, and they're kind of their feud. So I'm really having fun writing it, in this dynamic and this sort of confrontation and the main character and so forth. And so, you know, and of course in the wolf cult, you know, like sort of like there's some echoes of Slash of Crimson. There's sort of an erotic dimension. I don't know if maybe I was inspired a bit by Daniel Dark's novel, who knows, but the wolf cult, of course, they need to breed with humans. Right. So we get to have some fun there. I guess I'm getting ready for my next erotica panel discussion, you know, like,
beautiful.
So it's a lot of fun. So I'm having fun with this novel, and this one's, it's not a lot longer than Slash of Crimson, but it's definitely novel length. And then in the meantime, I've got a couple of short stories I'm getting ready to send out.
So you'll be the guy handing out backs of tissues with the book cover on it, right, on this one.
or maybe a bearskin rug. to put in front of the fireplace.
Fantastic.
So that'll be fun, yeah. So that's the new novel, and then I've got a couple of short stories I'm getting ready to send out. I don't want to jinx which anthologies I'm going to try for, but I've got a couple of little, you know, like 5,000 word type stories that are getting cleaned up on the hard drive. I haven't been sending out short stories, so I'd like to start getting going on that again. It's kind of an important thing to do, I think, as a writer. It keeps you tight.
Mm-hmm.
And the stories that ended up going into Slash of Crimson and Other Tales, the Other Tales are some short stories, one of which had been accepted into a pretty good anthology, and then the anthology never came out, and they gave it back to me. That was The Red Path. I'm sorry, that was A Gentleman's Agreement. But the point is that, you know, when you have, when you do that, you get to tell a badass story, and it's also a great writing exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
I agree. Yeah. And I got so much crap for years for my big books when I had the Rising Dawn saga and my Fires and Eden books. You know, they were epic scale. I think it is very important to, you know, write in other lengths. And I think we've talked before, Carl, about, you know, the all three. I think you actually addressed it in a blog tour. The novel, the novella, and the short story, and kind of like doing the different forms of fiction and what, you know, pros and cons of each. And I think for writers, it is important, I think, to at least try to, you know, to do some work in the different versions.
Yeah, I think working in a short form really makes one work harder a little, makes me work harder. Like if I'm limiting myself to a short form, there's no time for bullshit, and you really have to kind of make sure that it's kind of like writing a song. You have to catch somebody's attention immediately. It has to be something they're going to keep in their head and want to hear again, or want to turn the page immediately. And I feel like that's something that novels should really be the same way. But I feel like people sometimes, I know it happens to me, you get the illusion that you have time to waste when you never, of course, do. But you sometimes,
right.
You know, if your bullshit detector is not going off, you can dawdle, you know, and you really can't do that. So I think practicing short stories keeps that sharpness there, so that when you're working on your novel, you remember to keep that sharpness there and keep that pace alive.
But I would also argue though that within a longer format, like a larger novel or something like that, though, that you do have the ability to do a lot of seed planting and set a lot of things in place that don't necessarily bear fruition right away, but are going to come to life much later in the story, even to the degree that an editor may even raise an issue with you about it and say, okay, why are you doing this? Okay, because I'm setting this up here. And that happens a lot, I think, in series for sure. And I think that,
absolutely.
You know,
that's
a different dynamic.
In a novel, you have a broader cast of characters, you know, and you have usually, mm-hmm. you absolutely have that room and that wonderful, elaborate, dramatic landscape, so that something can come back, you know, a person, you can go off with this person and find out who they are later. You know, they can remember the brooch they gave somebody, which is the proof they were supposed to have that they were the queen, and then they lost it. You know, there's all
mm-hmm.
this good stuff you can do, but,
right.
And that's awesome. So like, I think with just the pacing and the tension, it was more like, I think I more meant just the actual language and the rhythm of the sentences. You know, like you absolutely could do all that,
sure,
that seed planting and so forth. But you want to remember that just because it's a novel doesn't mean your sentences can be twice as long. That doesn't mean you want to take too long describing this or that, you know, depending, you know, so like it's not that elaborate necessarily slows you down. It's whether or not every single thing you're doing at any given moment is interesting. You know, like a writer whose prose I absolutely love is Tom Piccirilli. And so, in his novels, like a novel like November Mourns or something like that, like it doesn't have to be the car chase part of the story for me to feel the tension and the excitement of the writing. It could be a guy with a black eye trying to look around in an old attic, you know, and getting that awesome, slightly surreal prose that he would write that keeps the line tension there and keeps my attention, you know? So yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I know, but so anyway, that was just a thought about, the different lengths of stories and how they feed each other. But,
oh yeah.
But you know, Stephen, you make a good point, because on the other hand, the antithesis or rather the another way of looking at it is, I do feel sometimes like there's too much minimalism, too much like there's no time for the grand, epic, elaborate story, which allows you to really fall in love with the characters and be excited. You know, the Game of Thrones type epic. Like, I feel like sometimes we want to chop everything down a little too short, just because we want to turn it into a soundbite, and that's not good either.
Right. Now, that's something I've actually talked about with Holly quite a bit. It's just like with different genres, some, you know, lend themselves more to, you know, more of the immersive type of approach, where others are more, as you would say, minimalist. And sometimes it is good to, you know, be savoring, you know, and immersing a little bit more, as opposed to, you know, being minimalist. And I enjoy that, because my roots, obviously, my biggest inspiration is like Tolkien, you know, that's something that was definitely a treat to read that. I mean, it's for me, it's definitely something to really immerse
absolutely
into. Yeah. And then, you know, one of my other big influences, like C.S. Lewis, is a wholly entirely different type of writer, you know, very allegorical metaphors, things like that. And it's, you know, a whole different ball game. And it's,
I read a lot of both of those guys when I was younger. And when I was older, I find myself going back to Tolkien more. But it was funny. My kids never quite latched on to C.S. Lewis, even though I sort of tried it on them.
Yeah.
but Tolkien they kind of did, and it's interesting. I think C.S. Lewis is a little bit more contextual for its time period, like oriented to its time period, than maybe Tolkien. I don't know, but they're both great. They're both fantastic.
I can see that.
Yeah. I don't. Have you ever read C.S. Lewis's science fiction series?
Oh yes, yes.
Like what is
that's,
it? Out of the Final Planet, Paralandra.
Yeah.
I hit that Hideous Strength. Yeah, that's a pretty wild, wild trilogy.
Oh, it is. It is. And yeah, pleasure to read that stuff. I love going back and revisiting a lot of that stuff regularly, and it's kind of interesting to watch the language of writers of that era versus writers of today, and just kind of taking note of some of the changes in general that have taken place over the years, and the way prose flows and word choice and things like that. It's pretty definitely been some movements here.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the language changes everything, right? But again, that's sort of like music. It's like you can hear that Tolkien is more of a, if we're talking about like guitar styles, Tolkien's more of a Jimmy Page, Tony Iommi, and then by the time you get to George R. R. Martin, you're listening to Patrick Pintoval from The Absence, or one of the newer death metal super high complexity, high vibrato.
Well, there's
fast,
a new Cataclysm album
complex
coming out, so there you go. So
there we are. Excellent.
That's close.
Speaking of Tolkien, gentlemen, I'm pouring my last little sip of bourbon here. I'm going to raise a toast.
Yeah,
to
you almost made it
to
the end. We got 3 minutes and 34 seconds, so you've almost made it, Carl.
Excellent, excellent. Well, it is a true honor to be on the Star Chamber show and to be invited and welcomed. So thanks to you, Stephen, and to Michael and to Daniel. I really love talking about writing with you guys, and I'm really looking forward to seeing everybody again at Imaginarium.
You're welcome anytime.
I heard that chuckle, Daniel.
Yeah, many more adventures ahead. Exactly. I'll be sure to refill my own
The white rabbit
ketchup.
Appears again. Oh no! Oh no!
Yeah, as long as it's not a floppy disk, then we'll be all right. So like, yeah, but and then before then, I've got some more blog stuff coming up. I'm hoping that my next author's own words, I'm going to send out the invite to the author very soon, and if with any luck, they'll agree, and we'll have a new episode of that up very soon.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, I know Michael will be have his mischievous grin when you come back to the Bluegrass State and join us for a convention or two. And
absolutely. I'm excited about it.
Yeah, we had a blast last year.
Yeah. Oh, no, for sure. We got to get back to the Troll Pub.
Oh, yes, definitely.
They're franchising it. They actually opened one in Dayton, I hear, and they're opening more of them. Yeah, but they are not under bridges. Only the Louisville one so far is under a bridge.
There we are.
How can you ever
consider that the real thing?
And I still remember the old Forester you bought me. I do not forget such things lightly. So it's your most kind. Old Forester 1870. I remember it exactly.
Absolutely. Absolutely, man. It was we had quite the bourbon tasting that evening, I must say.
That was the night of the seven bourbons, which is we could do a whole show on
that
one.
That's exactly what it was.
Or seven whiskeys, right? Seven whiskeys. Night of the seven whiskeys. But that's a subject for another show.
Is that like the seven
nine riders for nine rings, seven bourbons for seven authors, something like that?
Well, my friend Raymond who's Diana's Collie's daughter's boyfriend, mentioned earlier in the show. He has challenged us to have Night of the Eight Bourbons this year. So,
all right.
the bar is set.
I'll be sure to write an epic tune for it. You know, something like Daniel of the Eight Bourbons and the Cigar.
Daniel
of
the Eight Bourbons. It won't be Night of the Eight Whiskeys. It'll be Night of the Eight Bourbons. And then you'll have to make it through. Not eight bourbons.
Right. Right. Nice. This is an important distinction, eh? But right on.
Oh my God. We've got a plan now. So on that note, we reached the end of the show. So Carl, take us out and everybody, say your final piece here.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Stephen. It's been a great pleasure, and I look forward to more adventures and more horrors and beautiful shadows ahead. Thank you so much.
You got it.
All right, night, everybody.
Call in anytime, Carl. Call in anytime. Right. We appreciate you calling in tonight, man.
Absolutely.
Had a great show.
Great times ahead. Right on. Stay strong, people. Looking forward to the next
one. Right. Night, everybody. Rock on.
Good night.
Ingve style.
Night.
More rock on.
More. More is more. Night, everyone.